on 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning, the show that puts an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Well, today, believe it or not, is World TB Day. Not really something to celebrate, but TB, or consumption as it was more commonly known in Ireland, certainly wreaked havoc here in the 1940s and 50s before our health authorities got it under control. In fact, the name consumption, this was a term used to describe how people, if they were left untreated, were consumed by symptoms of breathlessness and severe weight loss. Well, we thought it was a thing of the past, but sadly it's been making something of a comeback over the past decade or so. We'll be talking to Dr. Joe Keane. He's a consultant respiratory physician at St. James's Hospital in Dublin. He'll be telling us why TB has again emerged as a public health threat here in Ireland and what we can do about it. Well, that'll be in the second half of the show. First up, I'll be talking to Professor Paul Davis, all the way from Arizona. He's an astronomer and a leading member of the Global SETI team. That's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Group. He's based at Arizona State University. We'll be discussing this idea that's commonly held today among scientists that life must be abundant in the universe because of the sheer size of the universe. Is that something that's true? Well, we'll be discussing that. And we'd also be looking at the impact on humanity should we actually make contact with intelligent life. What would we say to E.T. if we met him? What even would he look like? So far, haven't had any success, of course, in trying to find extraterrestrial life. So, you know, there maybe we're looking in the wrong places. And I should also mention that Professor Davis is the author of The Eerie Silence, which I've just finished reading, an excellent book which discusses these and many other topics. And hopefully I have him on the line now. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
So I guess we should say that it's now, is it 50 years or 51 years maybe since the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Life program, was set up. We haven't found anything yet, so I guess, you know, no success so far. I wonder why.
Well, in my mind, there's a very good reason why we haven't had success. And I should start out by saying you're quite right. There is a general assumption these days that the universe is teeming with life and it's so vast there's got to be someone out there somewhere. But at this particular time, we have no evidence for any life beyond Earth, let alone intelligent life. And so it's purely a fashion. When I was a student back in the 60s, pretty much nobody believed there was any life beyond Earth, and looking for E.T. was a bit like looking for fairies.
People Yes.
thought it was a completely crackpot enterprise. But the mood has shifted for whatever reason, and so now it's okay to look for E.T. As you say, 51 years of silence, so does that mean we're alone in the universe after all? Well, in my mind, there's an overriding reason why we haven't succeeded,
mm-hmm.
and that's pretty simple. If you ask the guy who started all this off, his name is Frank Drake.
Yes, still alive, isn't he?
Right. Not only is he alive, he's still active in the game.
Mm-hmm.
He's now in his 80s, and he's still upbeat about the prospects for this whole SETI enterprise. So he's an optimist by anybody's standards. If you ask him how many civilizations are out there in the Milky Way galaxy that might be trying to communicate, and he puts a figure of 10,000 to it. So then ask the question, how close is the nearest such civilization likely to be if there are 10,000 in all scattered around? And the answer is about 1,000 light years away from Earth. Now, the problem about that is they see Earth as it was 1,000 years ago. And there were no radio telescopes 1,000 years ago. So the problem is, why would they beam messages at Earth until they know we have the equipment that could receive it?
Sure.
It doesn't make a great deal of sense.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps doing this type of SETI experiment is a good idea, but it's about 1,000 years too soon.
Mm-hmm. And isn't one of the, just from reading your book, which is a great read, I'd recommend it to anybody remotely interested in these subjects, but you know, that we have this tendency, human beings, to, when we're looking for ET or extraterrestrial life, it's kind of in our own image, you know, that they always seem to look a little bit like us, these potential aliens, but of course, you know, there's no reason why they should look like us.
No, there isn't. And in my view, what they look like is the least of our worries.
Mm.
It's what they think like is the big problem. Because what we're trying to do is to detect signs of alien technology. And it's entirely likely that if there are civilizations out there, they'll have been around for an immense period of time. And I'm not talking like thousands of years. I'm talking tens of millions of years.
Mm.
We might be dealing with a system that is, say, 100-million-year-old technology. And it could well be that after that length of time, biological intelligence would have long since passed away and be replaced by some sort of machine intelligence.
Mm.
So we might not be dealing with, you know, traditional ET flesh and blood being at all, but with some very fancy information processing system or a quantum computer or something like that. We don't know. It's anybody's guess.
Because they're already talking. I mean, you do hear people talking about, you know, humankind entering this post-biology age. And, you know, we're only around as a civilization for a couple of thousand years. So who knows what might happen if we're here for a couple of million.
Right. It's quite clear, even in our own society, a lot of the, what we might call intellectual heavy lifting is now being done by design systems. I don't even like the word computer because really it's gone beyond machines that simply compute numbers. We're now dealing with expert systems and distributed systems and various sorts of electronic and information processing systems that that almost challenge our language. And you imagine if this went on for thousands more years, what we might be dealing with. And so I think it's pretty clear that if we pick up a signal or see, more likely see signs of alien technology at work out there, that we'll be dealing with something that is not, say, your traditional little green man.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I know this is a very difficult question for you, but I ask, in your own opinion, what's the most likely, given that it may never happen at all, of course, but what's the most likely way that we might actually see a sign of some extraterrestrial technology or intelligence?
I think because we don't know what a very advanced technology is like, it pays to look everywhere at every scientific database we can get our hands on if it costs very little to examine it for signs of something fishy, you know, something artificial. Now, there's a whole lot of things we might look at. One of these is large-scale astroengineering. Could it be that a very advanced civilization many light years across the galaxy would have had an impact not just on its planet, but on its astronomical environment, maybe reconfiguring the minerals or materials or even the structures themselves, something that might show up in a careful survey. The other thing that we could do is to test the idea that if there are any spacefaring civilizations out there that might have perhaps toured the galaxy or even spread out and colonized parts of the galaxy, could they have left some technology in our own astronomical backyard that we could still detect?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, and this is a huge long shot, I'm not suggesting it's actually happened, but it shows what we can do. For example, if they dumped nuclear waste here on Earth or on the Moon or something, we could find that even after 100 million years.
Mm-hmm.
It would still be there. Or if they had engaged in some sort of biotechnology, tinkered with genomes, for example, here on Earth, we could still find the signs of that tinkering even after an immense duration. So it pays to look for those things because it costs nothing.
Sure.
The genomes are being sequenced anyway. Why not just see if there's something peculiar about some of them? The book is really a call to arms for the whole scientific community saying, look, it may be that we are alone in the universe, but if we're not, if there is alien technology, we have no idea which particular scientific database it would impact. Let's just keep our eyes open to anything that looks artificial right across all the sciences and not just leave it to a heroic band of radio astronomers to carry this project forward.
Okay, now we don't have much time, but there's two questions I want to ask you. First one is, I think with Stephen Hawking, he was talking about maybe we shouldn't be too keen on, making contact if there is a civilization out there, because it might be something along the lines of what Europe did to Africa. You know, it mightn't be two equal partners coming together. You know, it might be dangerous for us.
I think Stephen's got it exactly wrong. If the aliens wanted our planet, it's been here for 4.5 billion years. It's irrelevant whether we tell them that we're here or not. They could have just come and taken it. And so I don't think there's any problem. And I think it's inconceivable that they would be interested in us, that they would make a beeline for Earth just because they knew that we were here. And so I don't, I discount that entirely. But as a matter of interest, Stephen Hawking is coming to visit our center here at Arizona State University in a couple of weeks. And we're planning to have a discussion on this very topic.
Okay, you're not having, it's not on the internet, is it? Is it streamed on the internet?
I'm not sure if it's going to be. I can't announce that definitely.
Okay, if it is, I'll let our listeners know here. But you're also chair of the SETI Post Detection Task Group. Okay, so
yes.
Tell us about that. I presume this is, you know, if we do make contact, it's your job and others to decide. What do we do then?
Right. That's exactly right. So this task group was set up about 10 years ago by the International Academy of Astronautics, and I'm not the first person to chair it, so we meet from time to time. We met in Prague in last September to discuss precisely these issues. What would the impact on society be if, obviously dramatically, if we got a message, but even if we just got indirect sign that we are not alone in the universe, what next?
It would be mind-blowing for a lot of people, wouldn't it? I mean, say, you mentioned in your book as well the religious implications and
right.
Just, it would have a very unsettling effect possibly on a lot of people.
I think it would for Christians in particular, and there's been centuries of debate about, you know, how do we cope with the concept of very advanced sentient beings on other worlds? And the church has sort of dithered around with this one. And for the last few decades, it's been off the agenda as something, you know, a little too difficult to talk about. But I'm pleased to say that now theologians are starting to address it once again. And I was at a meeting at the Vatican about a year ago, and these sorts of things are beginning to be discussed. But there clearly is a difficulty, I think, for all of the world's religions, but particularly for Christianity.
So in light of that, you know, let's say it's some kind of signal that's been received that the public don't know about. So, you know, what do you do? Do you release that information very carefully or, you know, what's the best way to do it?
Well, the first thing I should say is that SETI is not carried out in secret. It's an open enterprise.
It's not military, of course.
Involved. Yeah. No, there's no military involvement. In fact, governments don't seem to really be very concerned about this entire subject. So it's carried out by scientists in a completely open manner. And if something's discovered, we have determined in our task group that it would simply be impossible to keep the wraps on this for more than a few hours. And so my own feeling is that we should not disclose the source in the sky, the position of any transmitting source, until we've had a chance to properly evaluate what we're dealing with. And that's simply to stop people setting themselves up as self-appointed spokespersons of mankind, commandeering a radio telescope and beaming messages back at that source until
yeah.
we are ready to decide how to respond.
Sure. Okay, well, we just run out of time there, but thank you very much for taking our call early in Arizona there, I know, and I just recommend the book again. It's The Eerie Silence, Searching for Ourselves in the Universe. I got it in Dubry Books in Dublin, 1335, and we're just talking to the author there, Paul Davis, about various topics mentioned in the book. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, just moving on while we're waiting for our next guest, did you see a couple of items this week that I thought were very interesting? In Nature, which is, of course, the international journal, one of the leading journals in the world that publishes scientific research, it was reported just yesterday, actually, that something they've been trying to do for many decades, sperm has been grown in a test tube. Now, a lot of these announcements, we get used to these announcements, but that actually is a major breakthrough because it's something that could potentially help infertile men to have children, because it's triggering. What it can do is they found the trigger that's in the testes that can actually trigger the sperm, the immature sperm, to develop into mature sperm. This research was done by two Japanese researchers at Yokohama City University, which is in Japan. So, I mean, it's not something that's going to change how fertility treatment is done overnight, but certainly it opens the possibility to dealing with male infertility down the road. Another thing I thought was kind of interesting and fun, reported in today's Irish Times by Patrick Frayne. He's talking about this idea of 3D printers, not just 3D printers, but replicators, essentially is what they are, where we can simply reproduce something, like, let's say, for example, a lampshade. You can say to a machine, I want a lampshade, and it'll get reproduced in three-dimensional space simply by pressing click. So instead of having our printers, we may have a machine, something like a printer, where you can actually click and you could create your own teacup or whatever it is. And of course, you know, you might have your basic machines that can create all kinds of household products, and then you're going to have more advanced machines. So there's already something of a market in this. In 2009, there were 5,500 3D printers sold globally. But this is something, of course, where we're going to have the ability to not just print things in 3D, but make things in 3D. So it's going to open up a whole new area. Okay, so we're going to move on now, and we're going to discuss TB. As I mentioned before the break, TB is something that we all know in Ireland from days gone by. We've heard of it called consumption. We did have sanatoriums to deal with it dotted across the country, and we thought it was a thing of the past. But to an extent, anyway, it's becoming again a threat here in Ireland, not just in Ireland, but worldwide. And Dr. Joe Keane, he's one of our leading consultants in this area. He's a consultant respiratory physician at St. James's Hospital, and he's on the line now. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Sean.
How are you? So first of all, we've got a little bit of time, but maybe tell our listeners, remind our listeners what TB is exactly and what causes it.
All right, so TB is an infection. It's an infection that's been around for millennia, and it's probably the cleverest infection in the world, because one in three people in the world carry the bug without necessarily getting the disease. The trouble is, when the disease happens, it can be spread. It can be spread to innocent bystanders who don't have to sleep with the person with infection or share needles. They just have to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So if people are coughing, for example, that would spread it, or could spread it?
That's how it's spread. It's spread by coughing.
Mm-hmm.
When you cough, the TB that's normally resident in the diseased person's lungs gets thrown out into the air into tiny little aerosols, which a passerby can inhale, and suddenly then they have the infection. Now, if they've got a normal immune system, they have a good chance of never getting the disease.
Mm.
But if they're young, or if they've got poor immunity, then they can go and develop the disease. And let me tell you, if you have the disease, it's pretty nasty.
Mm.
The good news is we can treat most of it, but in some cases we can treat it.
Okay.
When it's too late, or when it's resistant to the normal drugs we use.
Right, we'll get on to that in a second. I just wanted to ask you a historic question, just to remind us. It was pretty bad here, wasn't it, in the 40s and 50s? What was the story there? Like, how did it become so bad, and how did we eventually, well, not eradicate it, but get the thing under control?
So, it's kind of a story of wonderful inventions in the shape of drugs that came online in the 40s and the 50s. In fact, really, it was only in the mid-50s that we had proper treatment. Before that, we simply didn't have the right treatment.
Mm.
And without proper drugs and treatment, TB will run rampant in the society. That was a big reason why things have got better. Another is that we improved the standard of living and decreased on people being overcrowded, and people were better nourished, and all of those things. Certainly.
Why? Just I was curious about one thing, because there's a sanatorium near where I grew up. They used to leave people outside, was it? They used to leave them.
That's
sitting.
Right. They had a notion that it was good practice to leave people outside. People had fantastic ideas in days of old, but scientific rigor has failed to show that they're that important. So, for example, now if someone has tuberculosis, we're in no rush to push them out in a trolley to get as much sunshine as possible and fresh air. That's simply not part of modern treatment of TB, and there's a reason. And the reason is because, scientifically, proper drugs are much more important, and proper ensuring that patients take those drugs for a period of no less than 6 months is more important than sitting outside in the sunshine and breathing fresh air.
Okay, so let's bring it up to date then. I think maybe over the last, you can correct me now, but over the last about decade or so, the cases have been increasing in Ireland. And
that's right. So Dublin, about 10 years ago, we had about, 390 cases or something like that. And now in Ireland, we've got about 470 cases, something like that.
In Dublin mainly, is it?
Or? Well, most people live in Dublin.
Yeah.
And this is often a disease of overcrowding, a disease of the poor and marginalised in society. And most of those folks live in Dublin.
Yeah.
So for sure, we have more of it in Dublin than anywhere else in the country. It's also a disease we see in patients who are living in homeless hostels, IV drug users, and prisoners. So we've had outbreaks in all of those areas I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And what is the treatment of choice then for people when they come in? What do you do with them when they come in initially?
Well, initially we tell them about their diagnosis. We develop a relationship with them because we'll be sticking with them for 6 months as we treat them with pills. We give them the medication to go home with at the same visit. I work very closely with a pharmacist who is sitting right now, in fact, in the room next by, near to me.
Mm.
We make it as easy as possible for these people to take their medications, and we offer them oversight if they have trouble taking them. And their medications is something they take once a day, every day, for a period of no less than 6 months, and sometimes for 9 months or a year.
Okay. Now, there is a connection with drug resistance, isn't there, which is a kind of a bigger issue these days.
Well, that's a massive issue. Let me tell you, how does that happen? Well, what happens is, if you don't take the pills for the 6 months, and if you decide to neglect taking them regularly, the bug can get very, very clever, and it can start to become resistant to the pills that we use. And that's really not a good situation, because, you see, we only have a handful of medications that actually work against this bug. So if, to those medications I mentioned, the bug becomes resistant, well, then the patient's in deep water, and we're in deep water. And by we, I mean the public health doctors in charge of this case. Because now, you see, you have an epidemic getting spread around Ireland that drugs do not help with, and that's not a good system.
And is that where we're at the moment? Are there a lot of people with drug resistance to tuberculosis?
There's enough to make it a major public health issue in this country that has to be taken seriously and has to be funded properly with respect to getting the TB doctors engaged in the care of these very difficult-to-treat patients, okay? If we don't do that, then shame on us. And it is a folly to neglect these patients because, like I said to you earlier, once this starts moving about, then you really are on the back foot. Prevention is better than cure. Proper treatment of each TB case is much more appropriate than neglecting this disease and letting it get out of hand.
And isn't it also because of the nature of the people that will get it that you mentioned earlier, some of them might be living fairly chaotic lifestyles.
That's right.
You know, if they're a drug user or whatever, they may be forgetting to take the medication.
Right. That's right.
We're
very sympathetic to them. We're very sympathetic. And I think the best thing we can do for some of these folks is hold on to them in hospital. Now, in St. James's, there's a plan to build a TB unit, which will be a three-story unit on the campus, and include a custom-made inpatient facility where people can stay for long durations, such as 6 to 9 months, and can sit in perfect comfort to ensure they take the medication. And I think it's folly to delay the building of that building. It's important to forge ahead and create that facility so that people who have a lot of trouble taking their pills or medications can be looked after in a situation where they spread no more the epidemic around the vulnerable groups they hang out with.
And that sounds really like a logical way to do it. Of course, you may have people who'd say, look, are you effectively imprisoning them or something by doing that? Or, I mean, it's all voluntary,
so
of course.
I think people who talk like that have no idea about the public health threat. And, you know, people with these chaotic lifestyles often have no problem with the notion of staying for a while and getting matters sorted out. And bear in mind, they benefit greatly from getting this sorted out properly the first time round.
Of course.
These patients who end up on treatment 2 and 3 and 4 times in a row, that's no good.
Mm.
Patients don't want that. They want things sorted once and for all.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you've developed some things on your own that, you know, with your own researches that can help people, haven't you?
Well, we've done our best.
Yeah. Maybe explain.
We've made a bit of impact, thankfully, in one or two neighbourhoods.
Yeah.
One is that we identified an association of TB waking up in patients after the use of new treatments. And specifically, I'm talking about a treatment called TNF blockers, which is used for rheumatoid arthritis and bowel disease, as well as psoriasis. And what we've done is we've noticed that this particular drug is inclined to wake up TB in the body. So to prevent that, we give people medication, which means the problem is sorted.
Mm.
And because we brought this to the attention, of the global TB community, it's now become health policy across the world. So we've managed to influence health policy across the world with a publication now that's been quoted about 2,000 times. That citation rate means that it's been taken very seriously.
Well, that's fantastic. If we don't actually move ahead, as you say, and build this unit then, I mean, what are the potential implications then for public health?
Well, the implications are that we will reap the rewards of neglect, and the rewards of that neglect will be an increase in our TB rates, an increase in drug resistant rates, an increase in threat to the public health by a number of patients who are difficult to treat, where our hospitals cannot treat them properly for lack of this unit. And this has been laid out to our paymasters, and it's something they have to reflect on. And in all fairness, the HSE are taking this matter very seriously indeed. And they're well underway. We have plans already for this building, and they're well underway to getting it sorted. But in my opinion, time is of the essence, and we're hoping to get the matter to completion soon.
Can you help people that are already are already resistant, I should say, to the drugs available? What can you do for those people?
So you're now talking about cases of tuberculosis where they have multiple drug resistance. Well, we've treated an awful lot of these people, and they take a huge amount of effort, and it's worth every bit of that effort. And we use very unusual drugs with bad side effects, but we get them through it.
Okay.
And we can help them. Yes, we can.
And finally, I mean, is it confined to, say, the lower economic groups, or is TB now kind of in other areas as well? Is it making inroads into other parts of society, or...?
Yeah, well, TB doesn't know the balance in your current account. It'll hop onto anybody, regardless of their income. And most of my patients might be marginalised, but a lot of them now, particularly folks who are older and have lived in Ireland when TB was prevalent, they got infected when they were kids, and the bug could wake up when they can't see these new immunosuppressants.
All these years later, yeah.
Exactly. So well-to-do folks are getting tuberculosis. And Irish people are getting tuberculosis. An abundance of Irish people are getting tuberculosis. So it's not just the marginalized members of society who are afflicted by this plague. And it's not just marginalized members of society who need protection and a proper service and a proper unit to deal with it.
Okay, well, best of luck with your work, and thanks very much for coming on. That's Dr. Right, Joe Keane. He's consultant respiratory physician at James's Hospital in Dublin. So that's all for this week, folks. Just like to mention, if you're interested in checking out other episodes of the show, I have them up there as podcasts at sciencespin.podomatic.com. sciencespin.podomatic.com. You can search by topic that you're interested in, or guest, if you know the guest you're interested in. Also, if you're interested in what's happening in general in the world of science in Ireland and beyond, you might visit the website of Science Spin. That's Ireland's only popular science magazine. I'm one of the editors there, and that's www.sciencespin.com. Our magazine is printed 6 times per year, and you can purchase it in Easton's or other bookshops. But if you want to access it online, you can access it for free. Just go to the website, sciencespin.com, and give us your email address, and we'll send you a file each time it comes out. So that's all for this week. Thanks, and talk to you again next week. Bye bye.